I think, basically from a sort of a British background, to think of the American pattern of discipline of being somewhat more democratic and lax. I think on balance, when you look at these things, they aren't really, they don't differ that much. They just differ in their approach to how to appeal to people's loyalties and be aware of their sensibilities and generate the response that you want in response to what you're trying to operate. I don't think basically they're different as far as within people, basically the same sort of Western European, UK, British Isles stock, which we all are. So I was suitably impressed. I thought that they were efficient and clean, and I thought it was a valuable and rewarding year for me, and I didn't find that I had to make any major adjustments to my thinking and so on to work in the same in their pattern as opposed to the patterns I had been working at. There were really significant differences. Well, I went back to Ottawa after that, and was there for a reasonably short time before I was sent to my first C command, which was out here. Which
was in August 48 to February 50.
Yes. Was it that long?
According to my cheat sheet here.
Yeah.
February 50.
When did I go back as? Deputy Director of Communications for some sort of...
It just says here, served at headquarters from August to February 50. August 48 to February 50, and took command of HMC at Beacon Hill.
Yeah, I went back and got involved in a program of establishing a series of direction finding stations for safe navigation those sort of purposes, finding out where people were when they were transmitting up in the north, in at Frobisher Bay, out in Masset and the Queen Charlottes, up at Aklavik and most of the Mackenzie and in Gander, and two or three in, if you like, continental Canada, like Moncton and outside Halifax. And these were direction finding stations so that when people transmitted at sea, you could determine what their position was from the point of view of safety or from an operational point of view. If it was an enemy or an alien transmission, finding out who they are and where they were from the point of view of possibly investigating it and do something about it. So I got involved in the installation and organization and operation of those sort of things for that year and a half or whatever it is that your cheat sheet told you.
I was wondering how you felt at this time. The Air Force is getting a very good whack of the budget of the...
If you're a sailor, you always feel badly about the Air Force getting a larger whack of the defense budget, and you wonder why your chief isn't getting more money for you. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you were in Ottawa at this time. There is a definite emphasis...
At this time, in the programs that I was involved in, there was no trouble with funding. But we were well aware of the fact that that there were... some very large and expensive programs, the Air Force at that time. And of course, like every other dog in the manger, you want the money rather than them wanting it. And I think at that stage of, say, Major Lieutenant Commander Squadron Leader, which is about the level I was at then, what you do is you look at your own program and sort of say, well, I don't know why they're giving the money to those bastards. We're the ones who really need it. We need a bunch of new ships and we need all sorts of things. And you don't really look at it in the overall defense. Mm-hmm. Thing point of view. If somebody says that their fighter aircraft are all worn out and they need some 104s and some 101s and so on, you say, well, yes, of course, I'm sure they must do some time, but let's get the ships built first.
Mm-hmm.
They look at it exactly the same way. And I think if you, by the time you get a little bit more mature and get a little bit more involved for the overall defense, I think you would look at it very, very much differently. Younger and less mature people in all three groups at that time were looking at the other things, sort of saying, well, why not us? And I'm sure soldiers were sort of saying, well, we could use 150 new tanks instead of 24 Argus aircraft or whatever it was that they were buying in that particular program period. There's always that sort of jealousy.
NATO comes in now, too. Now, does that change your role at all?
Well, NATO started coming in, and it didn't have that much impact, I guess, on the naval role. What happened was that the naval forces, which were allocated to NATO in time of emergency and so on, were still based in Halifax and operating in the North Atlantic area. And the development of the NATO Standing Naval Force, where we were making a ship contribution all the time, hadn't generated by that stage yet. And I think it's really, as far as the Navy was concerned, it had less immediate impact on deployment, where people lived and where they operated, than in the case of the Army and the Air Force, who produced the air division at the bases in France and Germany, with the F-86s and the F-100s. And the Army, which established, I guess, the old 21st Brigade or whatever it was called, which first went there, and then subsequently the mechanized brigade group that was situated at Soest, Werl, all those bases in northern Germany, where a lot of people were deployed, about 5,000 each of them, I guess, of the Army and the Air Force. And a lot of families were deployed, and so the impact of overseas postings and things had much more impact on the other two forces than it did on the Navy. The command and control arrangements associated with NATO commanders and so on was something a little new, but not particularly awkward to envisage or think of working in, where people had been used to unified and supreme command control during a war that was that recent that you could, you know, it was within the memory of practically everybody who was still serving, the fact that people were aware of the fact that they had operated under Eisenhower or something like that, in a very different area, on an international combined supreme commander type of basis, made the SACLAMP, Supreme Allied Commander Europe and Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic thing quite easy to adjust to. And indeed, where you found that your own commanders were in the command chain and you could see the logical link up to where there had to be some coordinating control. So this didn't really have very much impact on sailors, as I see it. There was a requirement, of course, to establish mutually understandable operating techniques, directions, signal books, things of this sort. But then, you know, signal books and operating techniques have been changing in response to various things of an international nature over the last 10, 12, 15 years anyway, so that everybody who was in the firm was quite amenable to that sort of thing. And I don't think there was any reluctance to enthusiastically take part in the NATO organization, NATO structure as such. The sort of things where there are difficulties are things which are not necessarily connected with the armed forces, but the standardization, for instance, of NATO equipment. Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at it from a nationalistic base, you could say that standardization of NATO equipment is just great so long as it's all manufactured in Toronto. Presumably every other nation looks at it the same way. And that's sort of been one of the stumbling blocks in NATO, is to provide standardization of equipment. Not of techniques and not of attitudes and not of operating procedures, but very largely of the things that are associated with the military economic base.
Well, how does it feel then to have your own ship?
This was fine. This of course, I came out here, and Beacon Hill was commissioned in Victoria here, and this was my first experience in my own command, where I was totally responsible for everything that went wrong. Not necessarily for everything that went right, but certainly for everything that went wrong. And it was really quite, frightening for the first time. All of a sudden you've got a couple of hundred people for whom you're responsible. You've got a fairly large package of the country's hardware under your control, with the immediate opportunity of wrecking it or killing them if you do the wrong sort of things. You know, there are some very exciting moments when you wonder whether full of Stern is going to stop you in time before you carve your way halfway up to Granville Street in Vancouver. Things like that. But and the odd picture of a horrified dock policeman running up the dock as you approach up behind him, rapidly followed by my mother and father who are watching me arrive. And aided and abetted by my nephew who was traveling with me, standing pulling on the end of my coat saying, "What are you doing now, Uncle Bobby?" And I say, "I'm trying to stop this son of a bitch if you'd let go of my coat." But it was an exciting and interesting time. And I was the senior of the two frigates, strangely enough. We weren't separated by many months or years in seniority, but we were largely operating as a training group. And all the cadets from the military colleges and all the ordinary seamen and everybody who needed sea training and so on, we took on, rather like the training squadron does here now. And this was fascinating work. I'd been involved in a certain amount of training at the communication schools that we've talked about, and I found it a very rewarding thing. It's one of the few things that you can actually see the results of what you're doing day by day as these youngsters come along and as they become more competent and more capable. I suppose it's a little like teaching. It has the same sort of rewards as teaching in the academic community. It has the same frustrations, too.
The crews around here at this time now? Was Uganda out here?
Well, Uganda was here but was being got ready to go around to Halifax. And the cruiser that was here and was going to stay here was Ontario. And it was operating here, and we would run into them occasionally. We never really did. It was close a couple of times. But we would see a fair amount of them, but they were doing other sort of
training things,
whereas we were largely doing a lot of basic sea training and indoctrination of people at sea from those sort of various sources. And that was very rewarding. The only thing about it, it was too short, and I think it was only about 21 or 22 months or something. I was out and gone again. It was just under 2 years, and I would have quite happily have stayed for 3 years. However, I was promoted and then moved.
Lieutenant commanders look after
frigates. So then I was promoted to commander as a result of my time in Beacon Hill, and shortly after I was promoted, I was pulled out and sent in charge of the communication school once again in Cornwallis, and that was a couple of years of adding one more child to the family and spending a lot of time training a lot of people, going through communication courses and being involved in the base activities and learning how to be a choir master and doing things of that sort and enjoying life in Nova Scotia and Indianapolis Valley, which we had never seen before. None of our family had been down to that part of the country. And I had only very briefly been in Halifax when I joined Skeena back in 1939, which we've discussed already. So this was a pleasant and a further broadening and educating exercise and experience.
There's Korea out here now, is that correct?
Yes, and during this time people were coming and going to Korea. Some of them went during the time I was in Beacon Hill. And at one stage of the game I had thought that I might be plucked out of the school to go to Korea, but I didn't. So I didn't get to Korea at all.
Did it bother you?
So I have no experience. At the time, I thought I should be going. At the time, I thought that I was the most capable one to go there and settle all the operational problems that existed. And I didn't know why they were picking these dunderheads that they were sending over in the Canadian ships as it was. However, it wasn't the first time that my particular views on my suitability for everything and Ottawa's views had diverged. Even if only modestly. So... Anyway, I didn't go, and what happened was that I finished at the communication school and went up to Ottawa, if I recall. You've got the sheet, I can't recall as well. Went up to Ottawa and was...
Director of Naval Communications?
Yeah, and was made an acting captain. to be Director of Naval Communications and run the communication and radio and so on business. And this was just a straight staff job of doing communication programs.
And that's the plum being made active captain, because that was the difference there, wasn't it? Everyone was guaranteed to make commander?
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody was guaranteed to make lieutenant commander. And then the gates started to be at commander and captain and so on, and the gates started to get narrower. However, I was made an acting captain, and one of the qualifications for being permanent promotion to captain is 1 year's sea time as a commander in the executive branch. So you can see how the future is shaping up. So I spent this 2 years, and it was a profitable 2 years. It was involved in programming. It was involved in the beginning of the understanding of the competition with Treasury Board for releasing
money.
Well, how did
you deal with your political masters or whatever you want to call them?
Well, I never really found any difficulty. I was well attuned to the fact that they were responsible for the operation of all government activities, and the armed forces just happened to be another one. And I found that one experienced the usual frustrations of you wanted a program and Treasury Board wanted it justified so that the public's money wasn't being squandered, and you figured you were they were wasting your time because you should be buying equipment and installing it instead of explaining it to this bunch of goofs over in the Treasury Board who were really just being obstructionists. They were just trying to make a name for themselves as misers. This was your attitude, and what they ought to be doing is sort of saying, my God, if it's a program that comes forward from a guy like Murdoch, just sign it. Yeah, because it must be sound. Look at him.
You know. What do you want?
Yeah. So one started to learn the frustrations of this, and of course, when...
Is there a game involved here? I mean, is there a definite way of getting things through quickly or easily?
Oh, yes, there is. Yes, there's a definite way of getting things through easily, and it is a game. And what you and you play it by the rules. What you do is you completely justify every expenditure that you want, and you completely expose all the alternatives that you had considered, and the fact that they are a complete consideration of all the alternatives, and this is the option which is to the best advantage of the armed forces and of the country, and this is the most economical way to do the proposition, and then you don't have any trouble with the Treasury Board at all. They say, right, the monies have been, what they really look at, you see, is the release of money, which has already been budgeted for programs.
Yeah.
So you put up your program, and they look at it and say, well, this is a completely, thoroughly staffed thing, and this is in consonance with government policy, and this has a large Canadian content from the point of view of manufacture, and all options and alternatives appear to have been rationally and reasonably studied and rejected or considered. The project is approved.
They don't come through with a grease pencil.
No, because what you do is you say, look, we need 20 transmitters because we've got 20 ships that have got to go in. Well, there's no one point in someone coming along with a grease pencil and say, we'll give you 15 because we don't want all our ships equipped to talk to each other. You don't have that problem with the Treasury Board. They're essentially a very sensible and very logical and very hard-nosed bunch. And they come along and say, you've got 20 ships to outfit. It seems to me that you need a 10% allowance, which is what we understand from the industry, is the sort of breakdown and replacement rate. And you've got 20 ships and you've asked for 30 sets. Now tell us about the other 8.
Mm-hmm.
22, 23 we could live with. But it seems to me you're telling us something different than the electronics industry is telling us about spares and replacements and so on. Now, tell us about the other 8 sets, and next time you come back, don't try that one on us again. And if you do 2 or 3 of them right, and you do them properly, and the rules are all laid down, you don't have any trouble with Treasury Board. It's when you're trying to do something which you have not properly justified to them. Because they are established to look at the expenditures of the taxpayers' money and say, this is a reasonable and fair expenditure. We would agree. We would recommend it to the cabinet, because that's all the Treasury Board staff does. They recommend it to the Treasury Board and the cabinet. Or they look at something and say, this is a badly staffed. It looks like somebody has just said, let's buy some. We cannot recommend this. We recommend that this go back for further study for justification of the numbers, of the costs, of the sources of supply.
But to go through all of those and have
things
properly prepared, you didn't have problems.
It's exactly like trying to get an extra $5 out of your old man. If you've got a good story and it's justifiable and he can understand it and it really relates as to whether your love life is going to develop properly, then you get $5 for the date. If you don't, you know, he's as tight with money as the Treasury Board, and so are you. So dealing with people like that with regard to either selling policies or selling programs is perfectly easy, provided you do it properly. Now, it's not always possible. There isn't always money for everything that you would like to do, which are desirable policies and excellent programs. There isn't always money for everything. And, you know, this is just like running your own house.
Mm-hmm.
There are 45 reasons why we should both have new Mercedes. But if you haven't got the money to buy a Mercedes, then just go back and let's run the thing down the line of the rabbits.
Mm-hmm. You went after this. You went after this to sue?
Yeah, then someone said, right, now if you're going to be promoted beyond this, you've got to revert to commander and get that sea time acquired as commander. So they said, you're going to go as Captain of Sioux. As soon as she gets back from Korea, Gus Rankin's going to leave the ship. You're going to go to Sioux and be involved in the, I guess it was the 2nd Escort Squadron here in Victoria.
Who was the admiral out here then?
The admiral out here then was Hugh Francis Pullen.
Good man?
Oh, yeah. Totally dedicated, sound sailor. Great disciplinarian, but a very fair disciplinarian. Good man. Lives in Halifax now. Lives down in Nova Scotia now. Does lots of good things in supporting the arts and theater and community activities. Has never stopped being busy. First class man. Used to drive me mad sometimes because he was such a stickler for doing things properly. But in retrospect, everything he did, of course, was to maintain standards. And I like him better now than I liked him then. I'm the same rank as he is now. That makes it easier to like him now. we almost call each other by first name.
Almost.
Except he's older, sir.
Yeah.
Anyway, I came out here and I was given Sue with a bunch of enthusiastic sailors to support me. And she was the oldest and tiredest destroyer of the whole bloody lot. And my main challenge then was to make sure that regardless of equipment deficiencies and age and so on of the ship, that its performance was better than all the new ones. So I had to do this.
Did it work?
Oh, yes, of course. When you set your mind to doing something like that, it does. Well, because the people who've got all the good stuff tend to get a little bit slap happy.
Well, this is something I find very difficult, because most people that I've talked to in the Navy, RCN, say the same, virtually the same thing whenever they get their command, finally get their command, for whatever reason, they set out to make this ship the best of this flotilla squadron, whatever you want to call it, which is all fine and understandable. But the thing that I understand is that if everyone's doing that, how can one always get the best ship?
Well, if everybody's doing that, you've got the right gang.
You've got the right gang, fair enough, but how do you make your ship the best? What's that difference?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Intelligence, charm, charisma, dedication, perseverance. Underhand activities. I don't know what you're saying. Give me the basic criteria for success. Eh? I suppose they're just dedication and keenness and trying to be a little bit smarter and trying to think a little bit more ahead and trying to envisage what's going to happen more than the guy you're competing with. I think this is the way it happened. And sometimes when you had an older and more beat up boat, the challenge was more, so maybe you were a little bit sharper all the time. This is the way I looked at it, you know. I had to run to keep even.
Did you get the recognition for this?
Yeah, I got promoted again.
Mid-captain?
Yeah. As soon as, almost as soon as I'd finished the year that was required.
Were you on the captain's list at this point for promotion prior to your year?
Yeah, I was eligible in every other way.
So what it really meant?
I was eligible in every other way, but it happened earlier than it was normally happening. I was starting to get ahead of the system a bit. but it, you know, it happened as a result of having gone at it the way we've just discussed about trying to make it the best and trying to, you know, be the one who got to the submarine contact first. And so, by starting to ease over that way, thinking if it was me, I'd go that way too, and...
anticipation.
Yeah, that's it. It's sort of like playing a little chess or playing a little tennis or moving somewhere along the baseline because you just have a rough idea that's where it's going to be.
Full of luck.